especially for the cotton candy. I think that was cotton candy fueled applause there. My name is Scott Kirshner. I'm a columnist for the Boston Globe. I write a column on Sundays called Innovation Economy and also blog for Boston.com. And it's really great to be here as part of WordCamp Boston, particularly with these two gentlemen, David Weinberger on my left and Doc Searles on my right. Last year was the 10th anniversary of the Clean Train Manifesto, which was a really visionary book. Can you raise your hand if you were on the Clean Train Manifesto website, you read the book in 1999?
Okay.
I just said 1999, not since then. I'm sure everyone else has read it since then. So what I want to do is just kind of ask a couple questions about Clean Train and then also what David and Doc are working on right now. I'll give you the very brief introductions. Doc is senior editor for Linux Journal. He's a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard, where he has Project VRM, and he's working on a new book called The Intention Economy, What Happens When Customers Get Real Power. David is also a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard. He's edited the great blog, JOHO, the Journal of the Hyperlinked Organization, which I think has been a blog since maybe even before Clue Train. It's been an email newsletter since the late 90s.
The name's been around longer. Earlier blogger.
Yeah, well, both of our blogs are post Clue Train by a very short distance, but David had a newsletter going a long time ago.
I should mention your books too. Everything is Miscellaneous and Small Pieces Loosely Joined, which come after Clue Train Manifesto. I guess the thing I wanted to start with is when you look back at Clue Train, and I kind of feel like with the original, we're seeing all these books now that are kind of tied to social media and how the internet is changing interactions, particularly between companies and customers. This was really the original one of those books. The first tenet of the Clue Train Manifesto was that markets are conversations. And I guess what I'd ask is that, you know, you had this somewhat utopian vision of how the internet was going to change relationships between people and media, between people and people and companies, corporations. What hasn't proved, maybe what has proved most true and what has proved least true about?
Well, I think it's become a utopia for social media consultants. How many people are social media consultants of some sort?
Or aspire to be one.
I think a realistic, and now I think a somewhat more utopian notion of what the net was and what the net did. It was this amazing new environment that created endless opportunities for everything and everything. And right at the height of the dot-com boom, we, that is, a lot of big companies, a lot of VCs, and a lot of small companies funded by VCs, basically tried to replicate what came before the web, you know. Let's advertise a lot. Let's create malls on the web and stuff like that. And we felt that the net was so much more opportune than that. So there was so much more that could be done with it that wasn't being done. And it wasn't being understood very well. And so it was basically a rant about that. And it started as a website. It was a website that came out in spring of 1999. And we wanted to be like Martin Luther, just pack up 95 theses and on the door of the web, and we called it a manifesto because that worked for Marx. And we just wanted to sort of test whether or not the things we thought were true resonated at all, and they did. So, and then the book followed and came out early next year, just in time to cause the crash.
You take credit for having caused the.
We've been given credit for causing the crash. I wouldn't want to take it. I actually had stock in it myself, so I wouldn't.
I think there are a bunch of things that we're actually right about, including the fundamental thing, which is, as Doc said, think back to 1999, those of you who, were
out of the womb.
And in 1999, there were a bunch of people who were on the web. It was a little bit harder to be on the web. You had to be skewed geekier than it does now. But most of the media coverage, at least seen to us, was focused on the web as a business opportunity, which obviously it is, but to repeatedly hear that the web is so exciting because now people can do catalog shopping online is a little discouraging. since those of us who were on the web, and there was a lot of us at the time, knew that it was more than that. So, well, I think what's fundamentally right about Q-Train was to say, no, it's not only about business. Business sort of comes after, it has to extend itself to the web. And I think it was also right, and this is, we felt that we were simply articulating what people already knew. So if I say this is right, I'm not claiming prescience. It was sort of backwards looking. It was being observational. What was also right, I think, about it was that the web is best understood as a way that people connect with one another, do the things they want to do. It seems completely obvious, but it's not obvious if you're coming out of a publishing background where the web looks like a place where you can post up the Times sort of e-paper versions of what you were doing on regular paper. And it wasn't obvious if you were a business and you saw the web primarily as a market. So the simple idea that the web, the internet, is a place where people get to talk in their own voice and connect with other people because they want to was, I think, fundamentally right, and still is right. It's not such a great observation, but it's the right observation. So I think that still holds.
Well, what do you feel you got wrong, or what has changed in a way that maybe you didn't expect or hasn't been entirely, entirely positive?
Well, a bunch of the things. One thing, thesis 74, I believe it was, which was wrong. And as soon as we put it out there, like 2 weeks after, they did a whole Harvard slap. 73 or 74 that says, advertising doesn't work, just forget it. Advertising really, really works well. And we have a lizard portion of our brain, and it just responds to advertising. So that was just flat out wrong.
Yeah, I was trying to think of what were Google's net profits that they announced yesterday.
The really broad thing that I think we were mistaken about, and there may well be others, the one that sort of we were, I think, deeply wrong about, is that we were, I think, too techno, I'll speak for myself, because we're written in chapters that are independent, so. I was too techno-terminist. I had too much of a sense that the revolution has happened, the technology, people will respond to the technology in the way that the technology wants them to, with the technology of openness, et cetera, and of difference, that is connecting with different opinions and different points of view in different cultures. And it turns out that technology really doesn't determine our reaction to it, at least not entirely. And so if you just throw the technology into the world, we will not do enough connecting with people who are unlike us. And that's not the technology's fault. That's the seems to be the human brain's fault, that we have a natural, at least deeply enculturated, preference for staying with people who are like us. And that sort of self-imposed insularity is very dangerous and means that we're not taking full advantage of the technology that we've made for ourselves. So I think we are too sanguine about the inevitable process, the progress that we will be making, especially in the light of some of the different things that have happened that threaten the very architecture of the net, which Q-Train does not foresee.
I want to just kind of touch on two or maybe three other areas and then open it up to your questions, because I'm curious what's on your mind. Particularly after this very jam-packed day of conversation. You know, Twitter, when I look at that, Twitter is this very conversational technology, right, that is about sort of open messages bouncing back and forth that are by nature very public. When I look at what companies have tried to do with Twitter, you know, many of them get it right. You know, they are there responding to complaints or customer service issues or, people criticizing the product in a valid way. But I wonder if something like that scales in that, you know, once a company gets 500,000 or 5 million or, you know, one day 50 million Twitter followers, if they're still going to be responding individually in this conversational realm, or if it's going to become much more like a telephone where it's like, tweet one if you have an issue with, you know, your IVR, tweet two if you have IVR for Twitter. Do you know what I mean, though, that like when a medium, when a communication channel like that is new, you can be human and you can be conversational in it, and to some extent with blogs, too. I mean, at a certain point, your blog gets too popular and you can't read or respond to every comment. I mean, is that sort of at the nature of these new communication technologies?
Well, my belief is that it's still real early. You know, the web, as we know it, has been around for 15 years. The net, not much longer than that. It's still early, really early, and I see Twitter as a really great effort that's probably going to get replaced in time. It has several problems. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, as it works. I use it a lot. I've got a lot of followers. I don't know what the hell they are, but they're a
Do you try to respond to everyone who asks you?
No, I don't. But that's not sport. To me, it's not something interesting to share. I'm a linky tweeter. Mm-hmm. I rarely publish a tweet that isn't a linky.
I guess I'm wondering about the direct message thing, because there's an interesting phenomenon now where, like, direct message for a lot of people has become, like, the highest priority message that they get over the course of the day.
I know a number of people, including myself, for which it is it's high priority in that it's the most unusual, okay? So we're all inundated with email. We don't use IM much anymore, or at least not the way that we used to, even though they're great open protocol. Jabber is a great protocol. There probably could be district meetings, for that matter. The problem with Twitter is that it's owned, okay? Mm-hmm. It's not public infrastructure. Email is essentially public infrastructure. SMTP, IMAP, POP3, these are open protocols introduced by the IETF in a nice, geeky way that anybody can use. I can put my mail on Gmail, I can take that off Gmail, I can put it somewhere else, it's mine, mm-hmm. right? I can't do that with Twitter.
Yeah.
That's a fundamental problem, okay? Google's been more respectful of that. And in the long run, I think Twitter probably won't be up there. They probably don't want to move that fast because they have to follow day one, or they've been beating them up all over the place with good cause, I should say. So, the first thing is I think it's early. The second thing is I think it's there's a problem with mistaking popular private services for public infrastructure. We haven't, and so the third problem is we haven't built out the public that we need there. So, an issue.
Dude, I have a different question for you, unless you have some burning thoughts about Twitter and kind of where that's taking us.
I will put out my burning thoughts.
What about, a lot of companies report to sort of have gotten the religion about social media, and yet there's still, like, a lot of times when you read a company's blog or you see a CEO who's on YouTube, you know, who suddenly has his own YouTube channel, like, you just feel like there's a real authenticity void there. You know, like, it's just the 21st century of, like, Lee Iacocca being on TV and saying, like, you know, Chrysler is a great company, buy our cars, but it happens to be on YouTube. So, like, is there any way that gap can be closed between, you know,
First of all, it's a problem with the firm authenticity, which is another thing that I think I'll say got wrong in Clue Train. That is, Clue Train talked about authenticity, and I forgot about that, and I looked back on the 10th anniversary, and I was surprised. It's not a term I'm really comfortable with at all, but especially when it applies to companies. So I'll bring the answer back to Twitter. So your question about Twitter, which was, before the vote to 50 million. Twitter is amazing. In a way that the web and the internet also is amazing. Namely, it works at every scale. So Twitter works if you have two followers and they're your best friends. It works if you have 50. If you have enough that it's sort of one way, I'm going to recommend links. It works for that. It works for 50 million if you're going to do announcements. But it's different at each scale. And the web's like that also, right? It's one of the only mediums. The only other medium I can think of that works at every scale is writing. You can write a note, or you can write something that sells it. It's a very unusual capability, and it's one of the reasons why Twitter works so well, why the net overall works so well. The problem is that authenticity doesn't work at every scale. So if you're talking with somebody in tech support and over Twitter, and she's responding and she's being a human being, there's a sense of there where you talk about authentic or no, that person really seems insincere, or just company line. It makes sense there. As you go up the scale, authenticity has to be different at each of those scales, and we don't know how to do it. And it's not Twitter's fault, and it's not even the poor CEO's fault. The CEO just doesn't know, because we don't have rhetorical conventions for this. How do you talk intimately to 50 million people? Mm-hmm. You make fun of yourself, but that seems to work pretty well. But is that authentic? I don't know. It's something. It's all rhetoric, which is fine. Rhetoric in the sense. I mean, it's the way that human beings figure out modes of communication and discourse, and we are very good at some of them, talking to one another, giving a speech. And these scales that we have, we don't have rhetoric developed for it, so there's no possibility of being authentic. So I actually feel terrible for companies that not have the space working at every scale that in media that's going to exist 5 years.
Yeah. It, you know, taking us in an entirely different direction, so maybe you want to follow up on that and some of your questions. The one last thing I want to touch on is just kind of the question of, like, stability in comments and conversations online. And it almost...
Why do you always bring that up, you bastard? Please let it go!
Exactly the response I expected. You know, it's this question of, like, we're all trying to spark... If you have a blog, you're trying to spark conversation on your blog, and you're so excited when you have those posts that have 10 or 100, you know, or more comments. And yet, a lot of times, you know, the conversation can trend towards that name-calling, you know, lowest common denominator, you know, thing. And, you know, do humans just, when we have conversations, and, you know, obviously when we have conversations and alcohol is involved, things tend to veer off in the wrong direction many
That's
times.
What we're
but I was going to say, when you have conversations in blog comments, a lot of times they tend to veer off into that same uncivil, you know, schoolyard direction.
So have you seen the Greater Internet Fuckwad Theory? Okay, look it up, Greater Internet Fuckwad Theory, and it's a wonderful cartoon that says, you know, normal person plus internet plus anonymity equals this, you know, guy who's making a bit, right? I'm not troubled by it. I think it tends to show up where people, where not serious stuff is going on, for the most part. I'm more concerned about kind of, you know, things like the kind of, like right now, the FCC has done a wonderful job of trying to be as transparent as possible. They've got sites where you can post ideas you like to share with them. And then there's a lot of ballot stuffing by the amen corners of one side or another side. Mm-hmm. And we haven't worked that one out yet. You know, that, and yet that may influence policy. People defacing stuff is just as old as human beings.
I was going to ask, what's your experience been, or what's your relationship been like with the commenters on your blog?
It's totally great. I mean, I have no problem with them at all. They almost always add value.
Uh-huh. There are no doctoral tutors who are just kind of constantly, injecting a comment into every...
There has been the opposite of an amen corner, and I always seek them out and embrace them, honestly. Because sometimes the criticisms are very good, and at the very least, what you discover is that, you know, unless they're anonymous, you just don't know who they are. They're human beings, and they have things to say, and I'm interested in what they say. But the kind of blogging I do is not especially controversial. It's intellectual, or it's humorous, or it's about photography or something else. It's hard to disagree with. You know, is it a good photo or not? But, you know, Jesus, a real piece of shit. Nobody ever says that. Yeah, there's lots of other people. So, I think the same is true with David. So we're probably not good examples.
Right. And we're elderly blogging gentlemen.
Great. So,
blogging elderly.
We try to get young every once in a while. It's something that we all socially engineer against on our sites by having policies, or we'll kick people, or we'll do whatever we have to in order to get it to the level that we think is useful and appropriate.
Can you talk about that? Like, what are the ground rules that you have created to kind of get the, you know, get good discourse in the comments as opposed to...
And the other one is by not going to places that are full of detectives that we're not interested in. I mean, sometimes a good brawl is sort of fun. So a lot of the, again, it's because of our demographic, I think, but a lot of the policy is actually conveyed through explicit metadata. The site covers a certain sort of thing, and we speak in a certain tone of voice. We don't feel like we have to put up big warning statements saying, oh, racism, homophobia, or bad language will be tolerated. Although I would do that if I had that problem. Mm-hmm. So we have sort of implicit policies, and if we need to impose, it's a problem that we all worry about, but then we also pretty much all seem to control. But the issue is, in those environments where the controls are lacking, either for technical reasons or more likely because of the kids, it's the social ethos. It's what happens, and in fact, they're going to be both vicious and, because they're more vulnerable, worse. Mm-hmm. So, generally, we control it. It's in the areas where we can't.
All right, maybe I'm more interested in that comment topic than you guys are, because whenever we ever see an article on Boston.com from the Globe, you know, if you an article about Scott Brown or Martha Cookley or, you know, Barack Obama, you instantly get 300 comments that, you know, just sound exactly like talk radio callers.
Yeah, if I get 3 or 4.
Basically, if you could cut talk radio callers off, that's what it would sound like. I'd love to hear some questions from you, maybe related to some of the topics that have been discussed earlier today.
Well, on that New York Times, I think, what do you think about that model for commenting on an article? Because it's evolved over, I've watched it for like 12 years. You know, it started off from that kind of fistfight and flames into something that maybe...
Now, if you comment on their Times, they're sort of selecting comments to post onto the page, I think.
No, you can...
My understanding is there's a human being involved that screens the comments.
It's, you can, it's moderated, you know, selects, you can post. So anyway, it does, it is moderated, so they review it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty much the discourse, you know, the rules are set out. But then, you know, you can rate it, and they have editor selects, reader selects, and... Interesting. I think that's a good model.
So the White House, Pat Novick, who was or is, I think she's on maternity leave, was in the White House, both the Obama White House, the Office of Technology and Women Policy, OTELP, something like that. Anybody know? OTS. Anyway, and so she, she's the e-gov person, and decided as soon as she got there that we should, let's have an open site where we can together, we all can develop open government policy. And so she put on the site where people could post ideas, and that's the next phase, and finally people are actually writing policy together. And in that first phase, where people posted ideas, there was a tag cloud. And if you check the tag cloud, anybody want to guess what the number one tag was for open government policy?
Marijuana.
Marijuana is an excellent guess, but it's not right in this case.
Nazi.
Again, very close. Birther. Another one was usurper. Now, this is not a fight about does Obama have a birth certificate. This is open government. But it's the White House, so you cannot say we're going to kick people off because we don't like what they're saying because it's off topic. Or at least it's a little difficult to do that. They would be accused. It's a democracy. So it's free speech and that sort of thing. So the site relied upon community moderation in order to set those birther comments also there. The UFO was also there. Those birther comments, birther comments are still there. The UFO stuff is still there. Usurper is there. But it's been moderated down by the crowd, and it worked surprisingly well. So there's a case where if New York Times owns its site, it doesn't have to worry about free speech issues. You know, it's their site. The White House does, and this community moderation actually worked, and it's worked in large part because Beth Novick set up the infrastructure correctly, the rules and the tools correctly, so that they got a worthwhile site out, which is always, as you know, the social engineering conversation, always tricky, difficult, a lot of little manipulation.
So one thing I would respond to, just as someone who does blog for like a established media site, is that it frustrates me that, and this may be something that would be solvable with half a day of good programming, but you know, it frustrates me that comments are always relegated to the end of the article, and sometimes you can't see them unless you click on the word comments or the number of comments. And to me, I just feel like, you know, it's a really interesting editorial feature today. I'm going to pull out, you know, if I'm the writer of a column or editorial or whatever, I'm going to pull out what I think of as the best 10 comments about this article or the comment that I choose to respond to and have a little dialogue about and, you know, not make it a subsidiary thing to the article, but make it, you know, put it on equal footing.
You mentioned anonymity and authenticity. Do you sense any kind of broad changes going underway in that? I mean, we used to be everything used to be anonymous. Everybody just had a handle. You didn't know who they were. And now people are identifying themselves more and more and more. Is that a trend you see continuing?
I'll take that real quick. This is an area that's totally not worked out. There have been people working on digital identity for already a long time, and it's a completely unsolved problem. Partly because we want, you know, in this environment, the real world environment, we walk around more or less being anonymous. We are just a person getting off the subway, you know, we're just another face there. And we need that. You know, one of the curses of celebrity is that you lose that anonymity, essentially. I've done a lot of work with digital identity. I was one of the organizers of the Internet Identity Workshop. You know, the digital ID world for a number of years. And one day my wife asked me about it. She said, what the hell are you doing with this? She's not very technical. And I told her all the things were going on with it. She said, I want less identity. I'm used to being anonymous. I want to be anonymous when I go on and turn that on and off. I want that to be the default rather than, you know, something I give up. And we have not worked that out yet. I'm not sure it can be worked out. I have some degree of optimism about it. I think it has to. We need technology that starts with the individual rather than starts with an intermediary. In the identity world, we talk about something called identity providers, and I think we go off the rails right there. As soon as Facebook is giving me my identity, or Google or anybody, and they're my intermediator, it's a problem. And until we get the individual back in control of that, if we possibly can, it's going to be a problem.
A brief. Well, 3 or 4 years ago, Ethan Zuckerman, who's also at the Berkman Center, and I wrote a draft of a paper about a call to anonymity as a default, arguing that that's what it's about. And the back half of it said, you know, and if you wanted to strip anonymity out, not have it be the default, here's the list of ridiculous science fiction-y things you have to do to the internet to make to take anonymity away. For whatever reason, we didn't pursue the article. But 3 or 4 years later, every one of those things, which we thought were just ridiculous, it would never happen, are either happening or threatening to happen. Hillary Clinton's speech on Thursday, which I thought was fabulous, I mean, Secretary of State proposing freedom to connect as a fundamental human right is pretty awesome. The one bit that sort of stuck in my craw was her defense of course we have to crack down on intellectual property thieves by taking away anonymity.
This is her sort of formalizing the criticism of China.
Yes.
Over there.
Well, this is her major policy address on internet freedom.
Yeah.
China, obviously, is the background to this. But it was broader than China. It was a very broad-sweeping speech, and that was the piece that really seemed to me to be wrong. The first question for the audience was, well, you just talked about the importance of protecting political dissent. How do you do that if you take away anonymity? And she said, well, you have to strike the balance. You can't strike the balance. You can't say, well, we'll give tools to the world, including China and elsewhere, the tools they need to track down MP3s, people are downloading MP3s, but they will not be able to use those same tools to track down people who are downloading Suangar stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. As far as I know, if I'm wrong, I'd be happy to find out about it. But as far as I can tell, you take away anonymity, you take away anonymity. So this would just be sort of you know, guff coming in political speech, but there's lots of activities that aim around the world aimed at taking away anonymity, and we should be paying attention, for example, to ACTA, A-C-T-A, worldwide policy standard,
and counterfeiting
that is being in the works. It's a secret treaty. We don't know what's in it, but it can't be good.
Can we have time for one or two more questions? Yeah.
Well, actually, that sort of touched on my question, which was about privacy. My main question is, do you think the new status quo, not so much using discretion on the networks that you sign up and the discretion with as far as what information you share, do we have to start looking at privacy in terms of a commodity that we essentially barter in exchange for services? Anonymity isn't always a solution. For example, photo sharing. If I post a photo of myself, even if I post under an anonymous handle, it still depicts me. Now that data is more than just identity. Is that the way we need to start looking at it? Do we just have to give up on privacy?
I don't think we should give up on anything. Again, I think it's really early. And the fights we need to be fighting are the ones that David just talked about, where the thing that we understand is the net shifts from becoming something where all of us are in control of our own lives and the way we participate in it to something that's TV 2.0 or phone system 2.0. And the fact that most of us get the internet through a cable or a phone company and they are in charge of that, and the internet appears as gravy on our TV bill and it's sold as the third act in a triple play, and these people have enormous influence in Congress, including the White House, to me is a more primary and proximal concern than you know, whatever technologies we might be able to create in order to preserve privacy, even though we should care about that. I think everybody should obsess about the things that we're obsessing about. But in the meantime, there are these other. We wouldn't have Wikipedia without this. Okay, we wouldn't have a lot of great stuff without this. But there are. To me, there's sort of like bigger issues. It's kind of like, you know, we build parts of this thing on sand, and the storm's going to come through.
Yeah. Question up here, the one thing I want to ask is, do you feel, I mean, is there still, do you have any concerns left over around what was kind of a big discussion in 2009 about sort of the, you know, are bloggers corruptible when, you know, Dell sends them a free laptop or Nokia sends them a free cell phone? And there was, you know, I think there are still some questions about, you know, is that really always getting disclosed, even now that the FTC has weighed in? Like, do you still feel like there's some gray area there about our, you know, what bloggers should and shouldn't do with free stuff, free press?
Gray area, so sure. But the growing acceptance of transparency as a norm gives me hope. Mm-hmm. You know, that seems to me to be the only way that we'll find our way forward. And people are corrupt. I mean, everybody's corrupt in one way or another. We're corruptible creatures. That's just the way we are. And so maximum disclosure.
That sounds like an admission that you took the free laptop, Dave.
I wish I took the free laptop.
Yeah, Ken Gilmore and Jamie Lassen have put up a list of, I think, six principles for citizen journalism. I think it's just one of Dan's sites. And they're the ones that apply to journalism in general. And they're just basically surfaces like transparency, full disclosure, you know, stuff like that. And to me, it's a common sense thing. I mean, you get a freebie and you write about it, you disclose it. If you say, I got a freebie, I'm writing about the freebie. And it, to me, that's not a complicated thing.
Yeah.
And that's not a big issue.
Yeah.
And bloggers, I mean, what's happened is that everybody's a journalist now, and a lot of people have learned the ethic that's been around for a long time.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that even in, like, traditional journalism, no one has ever been clear that, you know, there are some magazines or newspapers that will say, look, anything over $25 or $50 you can't accept. And there are some magazines where if you want to fly a travel writer to Fiji, you know, or you know, London to check out a new hotel, they can accept that and not necessarily disclose that that was the case for us. So I think it happens on both sides of
the fence. Well, one of the wrinkles in this is that it's hard to know when you're being corrupted. So you may think that it doesn't.
Because everyone thinks they're incorruptible, right?
Yes, in fact. So you think that this is not affecting you, and in fact, it turns out maybe it did. So maximum transparency is the only. More transparency than you think is required.
Yeah, I mean, if you wonder at all, should I disclose this? The answer is yes.
Question here.
Well, David, you brought up Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's speech on Thursday. There's a lot of consternation about Save the Internet and whether or not net neutrality is an issue or a non-issue. So, when docs started talking about telecommunication influence, I mean, that's a strong force. Lobbying in Washington and trying to address its needs, you know, vis-a-vis our needs as netizens, if you will. So I guess my question is, should we still be very concerned about Save the Internet, or is net neutrality more of an issue that's trumped up to create anxiety? I mean, I get petitions from Detroit Free Press all the time, and of course I sign them, but I really wonder.
I'll jump in real quick and I think net neutrality is a great principle. I question whether it's enforceable or even definable enough to turn into law. And that made it really hard to argue. I don't think what we're at risk of losing is not so much net neutrality as the net itself, as a place that's not under corporate control, that's not under the control of special interests in Hollywood or anyplace else. And to me, that's sort of my concern about arguing that net neutrality is that there are a whole bunch of people like, I'm for it, I'm against it. It's kind of arguing the color blue or something. It's not the right, it's almost the wrong, it's a red herring in a way. Even though I think it's an important thing, it's not the most important thing, and it's a distraction. It's become a distraction.
So I completely agree.
There you go. I was hoping.
All right, let's get really uncivil really quick.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, unfortunately, I don't completely. Part of that I agree with, I think is a very important point, is that the net neutrality is, from my point of view, is a requirement because of the deficiency of the current way that we deliver the internet, that's not, as my point of view, again, accurately characterized. we need net neutrality because the same people who are providing net access to us are also trying to sell us their services, their programs, their content, and that is too much of a temptation for the access providers. They are going to want to prefer that their voice over IP works better, that their Hollywood movies arrive before our YouTubes do, and so forth. It's just too much of a temptation. So we need net neutrality because we smoosh together how stuff is delivered and who gets to sell over it. In a better world, and this is the argument, one of the arguments that we should be having, but it's too hard to have in this political environment, we should be looking for structural separation, from my point of view, where those provide bits, and that's it. They're not also selling you the pictures and the video and the rest of it. And then you have a competition among people who are providing your bits to do what we want a competition to do, namely, I can sell you more bits cheaper, faster, open bits, use them for whatever you want. And anybody who has a movie can use those bits and move them around. So net neutrality seems to me to be absolutely crucial because we are in a particular situation. It is a suboptimal situation. It's the wrong way, from my point of view, of delivering the internet. Given that that's where we are, I think we need to push hard on net neutrality, even though, like free speech, it's hard to define exactly. So I also agree with Tom.
Yeah.
So that wasn't much of a disagreement.
Well, yeah. To me, it's a strategic and tactical problem at the moment. But in my ideal world, I would have structural separation as well. And I would say, you know, it would be ideal if the Fed said to Comcast, okay, you want to buy NBC? You got to give up your pipes. Mm-hmm. Okay? And you want to be in the content business? Then you can't be in shipping business.
Yeah.
And separating those two.
Well, it'd be interesting to see, like, how that policy would start applying to Google, right? You know, because they've been going in the opposite direction there.
Google is, like Apple, is an example only of itself, mm-hmm. and so anomalous. It's really, really hard to say how you would govern that.
Yeah. So I just mean, you know, the trend, you know, obviously under Bush and now under Obama, still under Obama, has been kind of more agglomeration as opposed to...
They're still selling a service, but not selling access. So the day that Google, you can get your internet through Google, then net neutrality needs to apply hard to them, because Yahoo better arrive as quick, results from Yahoo better arrive as quickly as they arrive from Google.
Right.
If we're getting access, if Google enters with Comcast and Verizon and AT&T.
Right. And already we're there, because Google has, this is what Google pays to ship out YouTube, nothing. And that's because they peer. And peering is based among the backbone companies on traffic, not on the capacity of the pipes. And because they have an enormous amount of traffic, they can say to Level 3 or some other company, hey, we're getting this for nothing, okay? We're going to trade out. We're going to peer with you. They're already an advantage there. I'm not even sure Microsoft or Yahoo can use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unless they build giant servers and they serve giant content at the same time. That, too, is a structural issue that has to be sorted out.
I'm just wondering your thoughts on cyber threats, particularly of a large scale. When I first heard about what was going on in China with Google, I think the news first came out that it sounded like there was this huge attack on 10 major technology corporations, including Google. It didn't turn out quite that way, but it could have. And you know, we have a very visible military that's supposed to protect our country. Should we have visible cyber police or cyber military that does the same type of thing? Or do we have to be concerned with it at all?
Somebody has to be concerned with it. I don't know.
It was like the last person to like want uniformed cyber police, you know, patrolling the Starbucks where people are using Wi-Fi or
that's
not
an
airport.
That's not what I'm concerned with. The larger scale attacks coming in.
I guess the question is really, do we need more protection against?
Well, I think we could have them. I mean, there certainly are laws, prohibiting this. And it's not like Google is not without its own law in a way. I mean, they have enforcement powers. They can say to China, we're going away. That's the kind of enforcement. The interesting thing to me about the China situation is that, and this hasn't been talked about that much. A colleague of ours, Rebecca McKinnon, brought it up, and a guy named Johnny. Chinese blogger, who also is a American fellow, brought it up as well, which is, it's going to be really hard for Google to be a Chinese company. What they want It can't be by you. They're not going to tell their 700 employees, censor everything, and here's how. It's constitutionally very difficult for them, as well as just morally appalling. It's going to be very difficult for them to actually do it. And that's, you know, and the Chinese model of nationalizing the debt and saying there's nothing on it is very much a model for a lot of other countries right now. You know, we look at it as something that's horrible, but other countries say, that's great, hey, look, China's doing this, they're locking it down, we can do the same thing.
So, just in a few seconds, I have talked with cybersecurity people whose judgment I trust, and they think the threat is very real, immediate, happening now, and that we ought to be alert. I don't know anything about cybersecurity, though, so I can't respond except pass along that bad news.
Dave Weinberg is using his anonymity to pretend he doesn't work for the federal government. Right? Let's take one more question, and then we'll move on to the kind of talk.
I'd be curious to hear your comments on Oracle's acquisition of Sun and the EEC's antitrust department just recently, a couple days ago, approved it. I guess they were concerned about MySQL and what's going to happen with that, and supposedly Oracle gave them enough assurances that MySQL can be developed. But obviously MySQL is the foundation behind WordPress, along with, you know, dozens and hundreds of other open source projects. And one of your reaction is
that's a great one. I'm not worried about MySQL. I think that MySQL, because it's an open source project, if Oracle decides it's going to not work on it, so what? You know, you guys that are working on WordPress, take, you know, learn MySQL, hijack it, take it off, fork it, take it off in some other direction on your own. Monty and David, the guys who created it in the first place, are very eager to get their hands back on it and stuff like that. I'm not actually worried about it. I actually don't want to see the Fed involved in it. If Oracle wants to, I mean, Sun has got it already anyway, and most of the people have left. You know, they bought a hardware business. They've gotten that MySQL, the corporate side of that, and with that, this is open source side of it still around. So I'm not particularly concerned about that.
I should mention, before we're out of time, there is this great 10th anniversary edition of which is available in fine bookstores.
The original is up for free.
I didn't notice that. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you wanted to mention that. Yeah, they believe in the freemium business model. So thank you guys for your time. Thank you for all the great questions.
We're going to have Ignite Talk starting momentarily.
Thank you.